To celebrate summer, we're offering a free pair of flip-flops when you spend £35 on clothing, shoes, accessories or beauty at M&S. Free those toes and strut into the sunshine. But hurry, this offer ends 4th of July. Only M&S. Terms, conditions and exclusions apply, subject to availability. See selected stores and online for details.
Wade, it opens wide to Wade. What a dunk! Forney blocked his dunk! Here's Wade against Green. Eurostep. Basket. And a foul.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Heat Check. I'm Wes Goldberg. With me, as always, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I am doing great, man. It is the eve of the playoffs, more or less, a couple days maybe, but it's an exciting time, and I can't wait to get into it with you.
It's fantastic that the regular season is over, and we are heading into another, what, three-month stretch of basketball?
Did it feel like a long regular season for you? Because I don't think it did that way for me, but I don't know. Maybe I was just more personally invested in this one than I have in years past.
It felt long to me, man. I don't know. I think they always feel long to me.
Yeah.
So all the recaps and previews and just everything that goes into it. I'm just like, I think the last month was really hard, just kind of like trying to find stuff to talk and write about other than what seed are we today?
Right. I mean, I think for me, and I hope this doesn't come across as bragging, but the fact that I've been able to cover games in person has really kind of changed and added another dynamic to this season that it didn't for me in the past. Mm-hmm. So I think it was a little different because every time you go there, sure, it's the regular season, but you see another team, you see another dynamic in action, you get to talk to these players in person. So that's kind of exciting. I mean, that's just, there's no other way around it.
Yeah. Do you feel like you kind of were able to see more and learn more about other teams in the league this year?
Absolutely. I mean, you just, like, I walked into the Chicago Bulls locker room, and that was a goddamn mortuary. It was horrible. I mean, and this was before they were eliminated from the playoffs, when they actually had a legitimate chance of still making it, and that team is just, they quit. They'd already effectively given up, and it was terrible. And then, conversely, Golden State was, like, this very exciting, you know, just there was a sense of energy as soon as you walk in there, and the guys are all talking to one another, and there's a sense of camaraderie. And that was right after, I guess, was it Steven Jackson had criticized the team or said that he could, you know, his Golden State team could beat this current incarnation of the Warriors. And so they were all kind of joking about that and kind of talking smack about Steven Jackson and, you know, just different vibes in each of the locker rooms. Like the Heat one, luckily I got a chance to go in there, and it's very different. It was, to me, what I saw from the Heat was that they were very high-tech and very, very disciplined, organized in the way they do things. Their PR staff, they were just a different level. And I didn't get a chance to cover the Spurs, but I wonder if there are some similarities between these two franchises that everybody clearly thinks are heads above everybody else. So it's interesting, you know.
I had to agree with you. I mean, I've not covered nearly as many games as you. I covered the one game against Sacramento this year, and I walk into the Kings locker room, and everybody's just kind of doing their own thing. Like, Caron Butler's just reading this weird book, and a lot of the other guys have just got their headphones in, just kind of like with their heads in their lockers, and some guys are off to the side chatting. Like, the PR guys are just kind of like, you know, doing their thing and whatever, and then you walk into the Heat's locker room, and everybody's got, like, a mission. Everybody, like, you know, certain guys are getting iced or taped up and or wrapped up with whatever, and other they're right. Taking turns and, you know, going in and out of the shower to make sure that everything's like, or there's like an organized fashion to it. I totally agree with you, and there's definitely a lot of things going on there. And then the vibe was cool. Like, everybody was seemed happy, you know.
Yeah.
and like that they were enjoying themselves.
Yeah
It seems smaller almost.
I wonder. That's an interesting one. I'd never really considered it from that perspective. But I will say that Josh Richardson, very cool guy.
Did you talk to him recently?
I did, actually. I did get a chance to talk to him. And he was actually eating, so I kind of felt like an ass just even asking him if I could talk to him.
But what was he eating? Totally cool.
Oh, man, I don't know. There were some kind of fried potatoes on there. I think it was like some kind of like waffle fries, but they look like very deluxe high-end waffle fries. I know.
Like Chick-fil-A or even better than that.
I think maybe even a step above Chick-fil-A, which is hard to, I know, consider, but yeah, I think that's what it was. And he was really cool. Like I was like, hey, you know, do you mind if I ask you a question? I know you're eating. He's like, no, don't worry about it. I'm like, are you sure? I see you're eating. He said, no, man, come on over. Really chill. Like you could have just told me to say, no, I'm eating, get the hell out of here. And I would have been like, totally get it. I understand. Cause I don't even want people bothering me while I'm eating, much less in a locker room. But sure. yeah, he was very, very open, very friendly. And maybe that's just being a rookie, but he seemed genuinely happy to be where he is. And he felt blessed. And I wrote about it today, but it was just, it was a very, very rewarding talking to him. And I got a chance, as did you, to talk to our boy Udonis Haslam.
Yeah. Amazing. The way I explain it is like you could tell he gets excited about things. I talked to him about Caron Butler, so obviously he's close to Caron and obviously there's a shared history there, and to say that UD lit up when I was talking to him wouldn't be accurate because Haslam just like never, he's like always frowning, but
right.
There was definitely like a happiness and energy to his voice, and it was pretty interesting. Like I'm convinced it's not that he doesn't smile by choice. He just doesn't smile because he cannot. And but he was very engaged. He was thoughtful in his questions and his answers to my questions. And I think the piece ended up coming out really well. I mean, and you were talking about your Richardson piece. I'll plug it for you. It's over at Today's Fast Break. So listeners, go check that one out.
Thank you.
And I imagine you had the same sort of experience with UD.
Yes, and to repay the favor, everybody should check out your piece on Caron Butler via Fanside. It was great. Really good chance. I mean, for those of you who may not remember, Butler was a big part of our plans when he was drafted in 2002, the year before Dwayne Wade came on board. He was there for two seasons. He was there for that magical 2003-04 year where they had Lamar Odom and Brian Grant and a bunch of other key players, Eddie Jones, et cetera.
Really good times. That's one of my top three favorite Heat teams.
Isn't it? I mean, you've got to put the big three era in there and maybe go back to 2006 also when they won the championship. I mean, those were probably the very best of teams.
Yeah, this one's starting to get into that conversation for me, and we should probably talk about that.
Absolutely. That's as good a segue as you're going to get.
For me, at least. So one of those players on this team that is very polarizing and Heat Nation tends to love is Hassan Whiteside. We're going to get into this playoff. We're going to dig deep into this playoff matchup with the Charlotte Hornets. First game is Sunday, April 17th. We're going to dig into that. We're going to get into the X factors. We'll talk about why the Heat are going to win, why they might lose, talk about the coaching edge and everything and some matchups to watch in that. But first we want to talk about Hassan Whiteside because he's recently been reinserted into that starting lineup where Amari Stoudemire basically was playing the starting five position for a good portion of the post All-Star break until Whiteside came in a few games ago. And I've not loved it. I really liked Whiteside coming off the bench. And these last few games for the Heat, they've won a bunch of them, but they've been rough. You know, they lost that game against the Celtics, and that's not Whiteside's fault, but you know, they lost that game against the Magic again, not Whiteside's fault, but I don't think that the structure that we had in place was as good in those losses. I think Whiteside coming off the bench just provided more balance to the team in general. But before I get into my big rant about Whiteside, what are your thoughts on Whiteside coming off, being reinserted into the starting lineup now?
Yeah, no, I'd have to agree with you. I think I'm trying to remember if he was starting against Orlando, and I don't think he was because I think, and it worked out that way because, well, not in the loss, it worked out when they won in Orlando. Because Vucevic was coming off the bench. So that was a pretty good matchup there for Whiteside to get some quality playing time there. And, going up against, I guess, Dwayne Dedman, I think he was their starter at that point. Right. So, and he's a high energy guy. They really like what he provides there in Orlando, even though he didn't get much playing time throughout the season, but that was because Kyles was pretty tight fisted with his lineup changes and everything else like that. So he didn't really get a lot of playing time, but he came in there when Vucevic got hurt, provided a nice boost because he was just, you know, their pace over the last few games of the season, once they had been eliminated from playoff contention, they seemed to play much better for whatever reason. Maybe there was no pressure, maybe it was just a lineup change, but whatever happens, they were playing well, and I guess it worked in their favor against Miami. I don't like it either. Like you said, there's something about it that just wasn't working, you know, with Whiteside as a starter. And he was coming in there and providing a significant boost, whether you want to say it's because he was facing second-tier centers or because he was just being able to get his minutes. I don't know if the exact reason for why he was more successful coming off the bench, but it just seems that way. He's still putting up big numbers because that's just who he is because of his incredible ability. But I think he was just able to be a little bit more dominant and was able to provide a little bit more of a cushion for Miami when they provide a second unit in there. You know, the first unit maybe was a little bit slower, then they come in with guys like Richardson or Justice Winslow, guys that push the pace a little bit, and then Whiteside could play well into that. So I think it was a little bit better for Miami to have him coming off the bench. So I know you and I had talked about it before. There was a little discussion via Twitter, if I'm not mistaken, people questioning whether or not it was a front office decision, whether or not it was a coaching move. We don't know for certain. I don't think they've ever really explained why he's coming off. I think they just said that he you know, they want to see what he's like as a starter now, and he's earned it. And that might be the case, but I think you make a change like this right before the playoffs, and it could throw your whole rotation. The rhythm that you'd established over the last 20-something games of the season is kind of thrown off kilter. And I don't know if that's the kind of move that you want to make. Now, if you look at it from a front office perspective, though, you know, you could say that Pat Riley wants to see how this version of Whiteside, the post-All-Star break version, who's been a much better citizen, a much better player, or more effective player, how he fits with the new and improved starting lineup that includes Joe Johnson and doesn't include Chris Bosh. And then that makes sense if you want to see it from that perspective. But again, you don't want to mess up the rhythm too much. So it's perplexing, and I don't think it's necessarily working, as do you.
I just don't buy the idea that Pat Riley told Spoelstra on the brink of fighting for a playoff seed and home court advantage, put in Whiteside, I want to see what we got here. I just don't see Riley doing that. That just does not seem like something that the Heat organization do. I understand the logic and some of the positives that would be behind it. I just don't buy it. But I do buy that I liked Stoudemire in the starting lineup. He was starting to fall off a little bit. Those last few games he was starting, he was a little bit slower closing out. He blew a few more opportunities at the rim defensively than he was, even though because his defense had improved this year from his last couple of years.
Right.
You could tell there was a little bit of wear and tear on him.
Yeah.
So I think it was somewhat some rest. But at the same time, and Whiteside was playing well. Like, he was passing more. There was a little bit more touch on his mid-range jumper. Which we'll talk about in a minute, and I think he was showing those things, and Spoelstra, I think, rewarding somebody for improving in those areas, and he was screening better, right? That was the biggest thing. He was screening like Stoudemire was screening, and it makes sense on a personnel level to reward somebody for doing that, and the timing seemed right in regards to Stoudemire kind of slowing down, and Whiteside ramping up everything that he needed to ramp up. I get the reward part of that. And I even get the experiment part of it. I understand it. I just don't think it's going to work in the playoffs because the way that the Heat have been winning games, it's basically been with that starting unit. And that was the case when Whiteside was starting. And it was this kind of jumbled starting unit that never really had an identity, and that bench was just depleted. It was not good. It wasn't keeping us in game. It wasn't keeping the Heat in games. And the Heat had to win when the starters were on the floor. And I tweeted this out yesterday. I mean, it's a 48-minute game. You have to win the whole way through. And like the Heat lost to the Celtics, they didn't have their rhythm when that bench was in, and they just couldn't withstand that Celtics run. They just didn't have answers. They didn't have an identity of the starting lineup. And even when they got out to that 24-point lead in the first half, it wasn't by ball movement. It wasn't by sharing the ball necessarily really well. It was because Whiteside started the game on his little run, Dragic had his little run, and then Joe Johnson had his little run, and all three of those guys were in double-figure points by halftime. And right. That's why the Heat those three guys isolated, won their matchups, and got the Heat to a huge lead. And the Heat played good defense, and Boston missed a lot of shots in that first half, and that was it. Like, it was kind of an empty lead that they had. They weren't really dominating. It wasn't a great half of basketball being played. When Whiteside's coming off the bench, it gives that whole second unit more balance. It grounds that second unit. You know, Winslow and Richardson have been great. They've been fantastic this year. That you can't ask more from rookies, but they can't carry the team. Whiteside right now can carry a second unit. especially going against reserves, and he can close out games. That's fine. And then without, you know, without dominating all of the airspace here, but there, then you have the issue of there's only one basketball, and that starting lineup kind of gets bogged down when you have basically four guys who need the ball. You have Dragic, Wade, Joe Johnson, and Whiteside in that starting lineup. And that's why I like Deng so much in that starting lineup. He doesn't need the ball. He could be effective without the ball. But Whiteside needs the ball. And that's what we liked about Stoudemire. He doesn't need the ball. He can, he'll set great screens. Right. He'll space the floor. He'll hit a shot when you need it. He'll get a rebound when you need it. But he doesn't need the ball to be effective. And there's value to that, that addition by subtraction kind of factor. And we've talked about it a million times on this podcast when Whiteside was starting. I never liked Whiteside starting. I always liked Whiteside coming off the bench. And it just makes more sense for this team.
I wonder if they're going to go back. I don't think so at this point, right? I mean, he, you know, Stoudemire's played a total of 6 minutes over the last three games.
I think two factors come into play. I think Stoudemire getting some rest. Maybe he can play. And then the other thing is Josh McRoberts. Spoelstra wants him to be their backup five. He's not. He's not a center. He's not even a small ball center. It's not working.
I know we're saving our playoff talk, but I guess a lot of the decision moving forward is how he faces in matchups, you know. And so, mm-hmm. you know, Charlotte starts a very, very quick center in Cody Zeller.
Yeah.
And then has somebody that's contrasting in style completely in Al Jefferson, who's much slower but very effective scorer in the low post.
Yeah.
So you wonder if maybe Stoudemire would probably be more effective staying with a guy like Jefferson because of their respective slowness, and whether or not Whiteside would be able to at least keep pace with Zeller. But then the problem then is, you know, what if he gets into foul trouble trying to stay with Zeller as he, you know, dives towards the basket on a pick and roll? Can he prevent him? Can he block him? I'm trying to remember what the matchup was like during the last regular season matchup.
You don't even have to go back that far. Just go back to yesterday's game against the Celtics. You know, you had Kelly Olynyk spacing the floor at the five for Boston. When Whiteside was in, he looked lost. Like, the Celtics, I remember one point they ran a high double screen, and the Heat guards didn't really know how to switch it, and then Whiteside was just completely didn't know to cover the basket on that because he was too busy concerned with Olynyk, who wasn't really, I think it was Olynyk in, or one of Boston's stretch fives. He was too concerned guarding his assignment as opposed to playing help defense. I almost like Whiteside, like Al Jefferson coming off the bench. I like Whiteside against Al Jefferson, and then playing somebody like Stoudemire against Zeller. That makes a little bit more sense to me. I don't like McRoberts at the five, because even if you want him to be your small ball five, he does like zero center things. He's not a center. Like, he kind of might have the height of a center. He plays power forward nominally, so you kind of want him to make him. You know, it's natural to slide your power forward over and make him a small ball five. But he doesn't do any, like, the reason he's an interesting power forward, an interesting player, is because he does, like, shooting guard and small forward stuff, but he's got the body of a power forward. Not because he can kind of bang low or do anything like a power forward would typically do. He passes the ball well, he rebounds well, and he handles the ball, like he dribbles well, and to me he's more of a backup Luol Deng. Like, he can get you a rebound and push the ball down the floor and increase your pace. He doesn't defend necessarily well. He doesn't jump really well. He doesn't shoot the ball well at all, and he doesn't stretch anybody out on offense. So he hurts the offense.
How much of his shooting at this point is him being reluctant to do so because he's not good, or because, you know, he's not shooting much because he's tentative, he's scared? I don't know. It's just seeing him catch the ball with some space there to let it fly, and he's just holding back there.
Yeah.
He bogs down the offense in a sense. For all of the ability that he has to pass it and to make a great read, you know, offensively, his tentativeness when he has the ball in his hands at the high post, I mean, that used to be his strong suit. That used to be where he could just shoot it from there or create some offense. And now it's just like, you know, he's going to pass. And there were several times in that Boston game there in that disastrous third quarter and even in the fourth where he had the ball, he was just slowing everything down. And Miami just couldn't seem to recover. He was killing us offensively, which, you know, he was brought in to do the exact opposite of that. So you wonder, you know, if his mentality at this point, if he's just shot and he just doesn't feel comfortable shooting the ball anymore. It's tough to see him walk with the ball in his hand.
Yeah, and he'll get the ball at, like, beyond the three-point line and where you should typically shoot, and he'll just put the ball on the floor and dribble right into the teeth of the defense. I just don't know if he's found his rhythm in the offense, or if he and maybe trying to find his rhythm, he wants to just pass the ball, and maybe that's the way he makes his rhythm, but there's something wrong. There's if it's reluctance, if it's a confidence thing, either way, defenses are helping off of him, and he bogs down the whole offense, like you said, and other players get double teamed, and even if he's in the screen game, like, teams don't respect him. He's not necessarily good at diving at the rim like Stoudemire is, and so Stoudemire helps right. the offense in that way. And I just, so, you know, as much as Spoelstra wants to have a small ball five to kind of incorporate, I just don't think that he has it. And the two centers right now, it's Whiteside and Stoudemire, and that's your personnel, and that's what you're going to have to figure it out without. And that's why ultimately, and it's not a knock against Whiteside, Stoudemire in that starting unit has a lot more value than Whiteside right now, or Stoudemire even on that second unit. That's where stats value is, and that's where he should play, and bring Whiteside off the bench, and you smooth out your talent throughout the roster. You balance it out over 48 minutes. Whiteside finishes the game. It was working. Post All-Star break, they're one of the hottest teams in the NBA. Luckily, Stoudemire has a few games rest. Hopefully, he's not injured, and hopefully that's not an issue. And I think you have to go back to that. And like you said, it's a matchup thing as we get into the playoffs. Spoelstra has shown an ability and a tendency even to switch his lineups from series to series. So things can change drastically rotationally for Spoelstra between series.
Now, before we move on to a full-blown playoff coverage or analysis, how bad was the Heat loss to the Celtics yesterday? Because for me, it's significantly, and I know that it probably shouldn't. If anybody's going to have a more balanced perspective, it should probably be me. But at the same time, just watching them give up that 26-point lead and to score a franchise low 5 points in the third quarter, lowest in the number of points scored in a quarter in Heat history, and to be completely dominated. Oh, I'll tell you, I mean, first and foremost, I'm glad we're not facing the Celtics in the first round of the playoffs. I think that would have been potentially disastrous then. But moreover, there's just like this feeling now that they were paper tigers, I guess, and that they were never quite as effective as we've seen from them over the last few weeks. You know, we saw very good versions of them. Even in that first half, they were really, really good. But that second half was so completely disastrous that for me, and I know for probably a fair share of Heat fans, it was really demoralizing. And I know it shouldn't mean much. It probably doesn't mean anything. But maybe you have a different perspective on that. How do you feel about the loss? Because to me, it was just very tough to swallow and kind of disillusioning moving forward into the playoffs.
That was probably one of the most upset I've been this whole regular season, was during that second half. So disillusioned, upset, I mean, name them.
That's not what I wanted to hear.
The Heat fell backwards into the playoffs. But if you try to look at this from Spoelstra's perspective, you say, okay, this is a learning experience, right? I think Billy Donovan talked about didn't they blow a lead in a big game? Wasn't it against the Warriors that they blew this lead that they had? And they were like, look, this is a learning, this is a lesson for our guys. It's sure. a point to learn something and move on from this. You know, if you're Spoelstra, you try to galvanize the team around it. You say, look, this happened, but we did the work in the 81 games prior to that to earn this number three seed. And like, learn something from it. Like, and the thing is, it happened against Boston. It happened against the Lakers. It almost happened against the Sacramento Kings. It happened against the Hornets. I mean, it's happened plenty of times in the last, you know, 10, 15 games. You hope that the Heat can just say, look, this is not going to work. We need to learn from this. And maybe if they won, this conversation about Whiteside being in the starting unit or the backup center again doesn't happen. Maybe this is a conversation that's happening in that coach's front office right now. Is, do we move Whiteside back to the bench and try to get and try to balance out this roster again? Or, you know, you hope that Spoelstra and the team learn something from it and use that lesson in the playoffs to make sure it doesn't happen again. And in general, just the idea of losing your last game before you're going into the playoffs, and if you lose momentum heading into the playoffs, I don't really buy momentum going into the playoffs. The games are too spread out. The Heat, they lost that game Wednesday. They don't play again until Sunday. You know, I'm not, as far as the momentum thing goes, I'm not buying it. But you do hope, you do, it is a concern. The second half, blowing second half leads is a concern and something that needs to be fixed, and they need to show that they can fix it, because teams don't go away in the playoffs. It's every game matters.
Yeah, I mean, that's as positive a reaction as you're going to get, I guess, is that, you know, despite how bad the loss was, and there's no denying that it was a terrible loss, even if it wound up being insignificant as far as their overall standings or their seeding is concerned, it was still a pretty bad loss just because they fell apart so completely. To learn something from that, I guess, is the best that you can possibly do. And if Spoelstra's able to, you know, ingrain that somehow in the team and get them to, like you said, galvanize and move forward, play more effectively as a result, then at least, you know, something good comes out of it. So that's a good perspective. I'm glad you brought something more positive than I did to the equation. So that's good. Should we move forward then into our playoff analysis?
I think we shall. So let's start with a matchup to watch. So we're gonna go through a matchup to watch. We'll do an X factor for each team. We'll talk about why the Heat are gonna win, why the Heat might lose, and we'll go to the coaching edge. But let's start with a matchup to watch. I'll let you go with yours.
Oh.
Yeah, go for it.
Wow, thank you. For me, after you, sir. One of the matchups one of the matchups I found most intriguing was you know, you brought him up earlier, Luol Deng going up against Marvin Williams. I think he's been, you could probably argue that he's been their third best player this season behind Kemba Walker and Nicholas Batum. I know a lot of, you know, supporters for Jeremy Lin will probably not like to hear that, but the reality is I think that, you know, he's been very consistent. He's helped space the floor quite a bit. He's a very good shooter now. He's big enough to, you know, guard Deng. I think he's quick enough at his size, and I think he's, you know, he's much more perimeter based at this point. So you're going to draw Deng away from the basket a little bit, and you know, Deng obviously is quick enough to stay with a guy like Marvin Williams. But I think that's going to be a key matchup there, because, you know, if Williams gets hot and starts feeling it, he could provide those 12, 15 points that could swing a game in their favor. You know, and conversely, we've seen Deng, who you pointed out, doesn't need the ball quite as much as the other players in the starting lineup. He's still very effective, and he can still get in there, you know, cut to the basket, get a nice wide open three-point shot if a defender lags off of him. So he still needs to be effective, and going up against a guy like Williams, that's, to me, I think, a very key matchup there. If Deng is able to do what he has over the last few weeks, be effective, and still play a reasonably high level of defense on Marvin Williams and limit his three-point shooting, it should swing in Miami's favor. Conversely, if Williams gets hot and, you know, manages to lose Deng offensively a little bit, then it could swing towards Charlotte. So that's a key matchup for me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like you said, whoever wins that, they do so many similar things, Marvin Williams and Luol Deng, that whoever wins that matchup really could, you know, that's one more position that the Heat or the Hornets win, and it sets them up for an advantage. My matchup to watch is going to be Kemba Walker and Goran Dragic, because if the Heat play the way that they want to play, which is going to be spacing the ball out a little bit more, doing a lot of ball movement along the perimeter and attacking the basket and taking advantage of a kickout game, that's what the Hornets do or like to do. And it's what the Hornets are going to want to do, right? They're going to want to suck the Heat's defense in and kick out. And Kemba Walker is very good at getting to the rim, and he's got a good mid-range shot, and he's improved his three-point range this season as well. I think that Dragic-Kemba Walker matchup, they do some similar things, and it's going to be really fun to watch. Just from a basketball aesthetic level, it's going to be a really interesting, just like grinded out, gritty matchup between two slashing kick-out point guards that should be really fun. And in general, whoever wins that matchup, and by win that matchup, is most effective in what they want to do. Like, Kemba Walker and Goran Dragic, they can make mid-range shots all game, but it's probably not what they're going to want to do. You know, even if Dragic is hitting more, he scores 20 points on a bunch of mid-range shots, but Kemba Walker is driving and kicking more effectively and ends up with 12, 14 points, right, Kemba Walker probably wins that matchup. So it's not going to be just a points thing. It's going to be who can establish their offense, who can establish the rhythm that they want to play at, and that's going to be something to watch from the very first possession of the game. And on the flip side, who can defend the other one? Because neither of them are stand-up defenders. Neither of them are going to lock down the other one. But who slows down the other one a little bit more? Who does a better job of fighting over pick and rolls a little bit better? That's going to be an interesting, because it's so even. And Kemba Walker and Kyle Lowry have probably been the two best point guards. You know, John Wall's been injured a lot in the Eastern Conference this year.
I think Deng versus Williams is mostly, if not completely, a one-on-one matchup. They're going to be on each other. They're not very good passers at this point. They're not initiators of offense or anything like that. At least not, not for a large percentage. They don't get the same kind of usage, as you pointed out. They don't dominate the ball as much. They're more spot-up shooters at this point, occasional slashers. So they cancel each other out very well, or at least they should. What's the key then to limiting Kemba Walker, in your opinion? Because I see him being able to burst past Goran Dragic for the most part. And then is that going to draw Hassan Whiteside, assuming that he's a starter, is that going to draw Whiteside off of Cody Zeller? And then does that free up Zeller for a flush? Because, I mean, you could see Kemba Walker kind of lob a pass over Whiteside the same way Dragic and Whiteside have found that combination. You could see him doing that with Zeller and then Zeller kind of finishing in a dunk over Whiteside as he's drawn into guard or to help out as far as when Dragic is concerned.
Yeah, I think you hit it. And I think the valuable thing about Whiteside is that, and I don't think he gets enough credit for this often, is that he kind of disrupts the rhythm of guys going at the rim. They're not sure if he's going to just jump up 11 feet in the air and swat their pass or their shot. And so you hope that Whiteside's on enough of a roll and within position enough. He's done a better job lately, kind of, you know, figuring out that balance of coming out and then going back and making sure his guy's not been covered, of that little middle ground that guys like Marc Gasol and old school Joakim Noah like did really well, of like managing that middle ground and kind of being in two places at once. He's done a little bit of a better job at that, but he's still not great at it. Or even consistently good at it. So it's going to be, if you get a good Whiteside, can he disrupt that? Can he get Kemba Walker off his rhythm? And then to answer your first question about guarding Kemba Walker, I mean, it's going to be a lot of like what Justice Winslow and Josh Richardson do, of just kind of getting their hands in, you know, near his hands and near the basketball and trying to just take him off his game, take him off his rhythm, making him think, you know, an extra step, or making sure that he can't just get to the rim smoothly and get a clean pass off. It's going to be a lot of that stuff that I think is going to be how you guard Kemba Walker.
If I'm not mistaken, I think if Walker gets, you know, if he's effective against Dragic and gets Dragic into foul trouble, then that would probably lead to bringing a certain player off the bench who might or might not fit into your X factor for the game. Am I correct here?
You're correct. Let's get All into right. it. Josh Richardson is my X factor of the game, I think. For what you're saying, if Dragic gets into foul trouble, or if he, you know, gets a few more teeth knocked out and can't play, which I can't even imagine happening, because, you know,
that's never stopped him before.
Never stopped him before. Can we just like, that was amazing, aside. Right? Like, he had a bone knocked out of his face and he just tossed it aside and kept playing, and he had the ball.
Well, and you saw John Barry in last night's broadcast kind of minimize it. Do you see? I don't know if you saw the broadcast or not, but he was just kind of talking about, oh, I've had teeth knocked out before. And it's just like, really? I mean,
John Barry's the worst. John Barry is the worst, and everybody hates John Barry. So I kind of tuned John Barry out.
Okay. He did, though, to his credit, he did give the Heat organization props on developing their young players, something that I've never heard any national broadcaster do. Like you and I have talked about it. We talked about it last week when Chris was on the show. You know, the Heat are very effective at developing players and have been for a few years now. And it's something that's largely ignored by the media. And Barry actually pointed out how Tyler Johnson and others, you know, Richardson, Whiteside, et cetera, have all come through their D-League affiliate and have blossomed into, you know, reasonable players. So props to John Barry for pointing it out, but not for dismissing the fact that Goran got his teeth knocked out and there was no big deal. That was ridiculous. I mean,
that's a major deal.
Yeah.
We just need Dragic and Westbrook in a backcourt together so they get dents and teeth knocked into their faces. It's about unstoppable.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible that he was able to keep playing through it and kind of pissed him off, you know, so that's good. Give him a little edge.
So back to Dragic, if, you know, for whatever reason he can't play, it's not going to be because of injury or teeth being not in his mouth, but Josh Richardson to me is the X factor, just because if you look at the way that these teams kind of line up, they want to do similar things, like I mentioned with Dragic and Walker, Dang and Marvin Williams even. To a certain respect, they kind of want to try to do the same things. They want to establish a rhythm to get their offense in the game. Defensively, they're going to be there. You know, Steve Clifford and Eric Spoelstra will get to them later, but they're going to have their defenses ready to play for this game. But that bench for Charlotte is kind of, to me, what makes the difference in this series and why the Heat are the favorites in this series. You look at what the Heat have with Josh Richardson, Justice Winslow, Gerald Green can kind of get going, Stoudemire or Whiteside, whichever one's coming off the bench. The bench has rallied behind Winslow and Richardson. Charlotte's got Jeremy Lin. He's good. Frank Kaminsky's been very good this year as well. Al Jefferson's coming off the bench, but he's not been consistent this season. I think that Miami's bench in general has a little bit of a higher ceiling to me than Charlotte's, or maybe fit. There might be a better fit there. It tends to keep the rhythm a little bit more, while Charlotte's is more of a change of pace type situational thing, if that makes sense. And Josh Richardson has been one of the hottest three-point shooters in the league since the All-Star break, and he can kind of not only open up Miami's offense with that three-point shot, but, you know, three-point shots are worth more than two-point shots. He can score a lot of points for the Heat off the bench and kind of be their sixth man and lift that team and give it that energy and that boost that it might need to get through four or five games, whatever it's going to be.
That's a good one. I mean, he certainly has been a major part of, you know, what they've done over the last few weeks. You know, Eastern Conference Rookie of the Month in March, shooting almost 60% from three-point range, 40% in April. So clearly he's turned it around, and he's still able to bring a high level of intensity on defense,
right,
as well as some much-needed athleticism there. So, I mean, he could definitely help swing the series in Miami's favor if he's able to provide that boost off the bench and kind of maintain the pace of the second unit. So that's certainly a big one. But for me, I kind of went a little bit differently as far as that perspective, because I think that despite how much he's beloved by the Miami Heat fan base, I think Dwayne Wade is still largely the team's biggest X factor, because I think we saw this in the Boston matchup. He it's tough to say that he's slowing things down completely, because he's still effective in spots. And as much as we all love Dwayne Wade, he's not necessarily going to be the most effective player out there. He does not necessarily lend himself at this point in his career to what works best for Miami offensively or defensively. I mean, there are times where he's, you know, challenging foul calls or not really in position, and he's not necessarily the kind of player that we expect him or want him to be. And so that's tough to watch. And so when you look at Wade's playoff history, although he was carrying the team in 2008 and 2009, he took a step back in the Big Three era, didn't go to the playoffs last year. So we're talking about now he's a much older version of himself. It's been 6 years since he was the kind of player who needed to carry a team, and he's going to be expected to do so this time around. And how he responds to this, I don't know for certain. I don't think anybody knows. I think we're all expecting Wade to be a consistent great player, because that's who he's been throughout his career. But he could be, a slightly better version of Kobe Bryant. You know, very ineffective, taking a lot of bad shots.
Scoring 60 points.
Well, that would be nice, but not if he had to take 50 field goals in order to do so. But, we're not sure what kind of a version of Wade we're going to see. And we saw different good and bad versions of him over the course of the regular season. There were times where he was particularly effective, getting the hoop easily. Courtney Lee's a pretty solid defender, so I think he's going to create a matchup problem there for Wade. Wade should still be able to have the advantage overall, but I think, you know, we're not quite sure what we're going to see out of him. And that's what's, you know, particularly concerning for me, is that we might get a very good version of him when it's uber effective and within the, you know, context of the offense. You know, he pushes the ball well, or we could see a guy who kind of takes his time bringing the ball up court, puts up a contested 19-footer, and is not necessarily interested in and involving the rest of his teammates. Although he's always been a playmaker throughout his career, there are times where he's still a little selfish with the ball because he wants to get himself going, and that's fine. You know, that's part of what's made Wade the Hall of Fame player that he is. But you want to see him at the very best of himself, rather than the not so good that we've seen at times this year.
The Heat this year don't have a 20-point per game scorer. And that's the first time in a while. I don't know the number, but it's right. The first time in a long time that's been so. So I think that lends itself to your theory that Dwayne Wade, if he can be that 20 point per game scorer that he's been for his entire career to this point, basically, that really sets up well for the Heat because they haven't gotten that from him all season. He's had games, and there in the beginning of the year he averaged 20 plus points a game. He's had great games this year. He just hasn't been that. And he hasn't been that lately, particularly after the All-Star break. So if he can get back to that level, if he can ramp it up for the playoffs, that really sets the Heat up well and kind of gets them to that next level. And they're going to need something like that. You don't want to say hero ball, but they're going to need somebody that can do those hero things, especially if they want to get through the Raptors, and not to even mention the Cavaliers. Right. But Charlotte's X Factor. I've got Frank Kaminsky for this one. And the reason I have Frank Kaminsky is solely based on what I watched the Heat struggle with last night against the Celtics. If Kaminsky can come in and hit some shots, he doesn't necessarily have to be great offensively, or I'm sorry, defensively. But if he can come in, stretch the Heat's defense, this Josh McRoberts thing, not to harp on it, but it's not working. And so if Spoelstra feels like he needs to go to McRoberts to defend Frank Kaminsky, who's a stretch five, then I worry about that because McRoberts isn't great defensively. He's not going to be able to defend Kaminsky. He really hurts the team offensively, which we've talked about. And Miami seemed to be out of whack with that five-out system that Boston was running. And they haven't played Boston well all season. It wasn't just that game. So I worry about that element that Kaminsky can bring and create this five-out system in Charlotte that the Hornets have been basically running with this whole year. It's why they drafted Kaminsky in the first place. I worry about Miami's switching ability. I worry about their knowledge of the assignments, especially with two rookies who haven't been in playoff basketball. They're very, very good defenders who do a tremendous job within the game of defending screens and pick and rolls and stuff, but it's the playoffs. It's different. They're still rookies. Dwayne Wade, what kind of energy is he going to be able to give to that? Joe Johnson, all these guys. Goran Dragic, who's an average at best defender at times. I just worry about this entire package, and I think that five-out system really puts a lot of these guys on islands that can hurt the Heat.
He's their third center, effectively, right? So they start Zeller, then they bring in Jefferson, and then Kaminsky gets a few minutes here and there?
Right, and he'll get minutes at power forward, too. But
Okay. Yeah, does he play the four with Jefferson in there? Is that how it works?
Yeah, typically.
Okay. Yeah,
so, wonder if you know, Steve Clifford is a good enough coach. I think if Kaminsky is going, I think there's lineups with Marvin Williams and Kaminsky, and that's the one that scares me.
Yeah, that's dangerous. I mean, that was their Miami's Achilles heel against Boston, and I think you'll see a lot of that. I think Clifford is a good enough coach. I think we'll talk about him a little bit more later. But for me, I had originally thought that Jeremy Lin was going to be Charlotte's biggest X factor, sure, because he's been struggling over the last couple of weeks, and you know, a lot of Charlotte fans think that he's quote unquote due for a breakout. So I think we might see a better version of him than what we've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think he's kind of a guy that I think when he's playing in rhythm and knocks down a couple of shots, he's not necessarily, I don't know if I would hesitate to call him streaky, but he certainly does feel a little bit more confident. It gets it going a little better, and he's willing and able to put up the shot from long range as well. So, you know, he could be a dangerous scorer off them. I like the matchup between him and Richardson. I think it tilts in Miami's favor. I think he could probably defend him effectively and limit him. So that should be an interesting one.
I think the problem with Lin is that a lot of people said that Walker and Lin can't coexist in a backcourt, but the numbers say otherwise. That's right. Charlotte's best lineup is with Kemba Walker and Jeremy Lin, at least by net rating via NBA.com. And it gives him two bona fide ball handlers who can slash and kick. And that's scary, especially when you consider the two guards that Miami starts with is Wade and Dragic, who are, you know, average defenders. And that's a concern.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a tough one. Again, I think it tilts in Miami's favor, but I think if Lin seems to, if he can bounce back from the rough spot he's hit towards the close of the season, I think he could be very dangerous. And, you know, a lot of Miami fans think of Lin as kind of washed up because he's been with a number of teams, Houston, New York, Los Angeles, of course, he started off with the Knicks. And I think they think of him from that perspective of what happened during the Big Three era when Linsanity was effectively crushed by the Big Three. They made a point of demoralizing him and breaking him down on national television. And that's all fine and good. But he's evolved into a serviceable player. He was never supposed to be a
Right.
superstar. What happened in New York was the right place at the right time, and the player starting to grow into himself, and that's fine, but that's not the player he is. I think he's moved on past that, and again, he's now an effective bench player. He can still do a lot. He can start on occasion. So, he was a good pickup for them, and partly why Charlotte has been able to turn around their team as completely as they have. The fact that they were playing a completely different style of basketball last season, and now they are one of the better shooting teams in the league. Got some numbers here that I jotted down specifically for this. I try to be professional about it and actually take notes.
Wow.
They've taken the fourth most attempts in the NBA. That's incredible.
Wow.
Behind Golden State, Houston, that's wired exactly to do that, and Cleveland, that puts up a lot of threes. And they're the eighth best in overall percentage, 36.2 from 3-point range.
I like Lynn. I agree with you. I think he really opens up that second line, that second unit for them, gives them a bona fide ball handler, someone to run the offense, basically a backup point guard, a backup Kemba Walker, and that's what he does. And I put him at, he's on my sixth man of the year ballot that nobody asked for. So
Wow.
I think he's been good. Not that anybody cares. I'll email it to the NBA. What is it? NBA@gmail.com, I think.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'll make sure I get that one in before the end of the night. Yeah, let's move on to our next segment. Why the Heat will win, or do we want to do why they'll lose first? I think let's switch it up. Let's do why they'll lose first, and we'll that way we can get into a positive. Start negative. Give me the bad news first, David. Why are they going to lose?
I think it's if they wind up fouling the hell out of Charlotte. I think that Charlotte gets to the line quite a bit. They're very effective in that sense. They're 11th overall in free throw attempts for the NBA this season, fifth in percentage. So they're a very good shooting team. I think Miami has to play their defense perfectly in order to keep Charlotte off balance and keep them from getting into that comfortable rhythm. Between their perimeter shooting, their ability to get to the rim and get to the line effectively, they are very, very dangerous. So I think if Miami can play their very best version defensively, which is why I think home court advantage was such a big part of their success or their chances at success in the postseason, because they play a little bit better defensively at home than they do away. They're a little bit more engaged. So I think that's the key there, is to play their best defensively. I know that sounds maybe a little oversimplistic, but it's crucial against a team like Charlotte that is very well coached. They don't turn the ball over, so you're not going to be able to get a lot of those fast break opportunities that you hope. You're not going to force them. They make good decisions, so you have to play very effectively on defense in order to prevent them from getting into a rhythm.
Yeah, I think you hit on it, and that 3-point, the 3-point concern that you brought up earlier. If like threes are worth more than twos, and Miami scores a lot of twos, and they don't score a lot of threes, and if Charlotte can go basically possession with them by Lynn and Walker and Kaminsky and Batum draining 3-pointers, if they get hot, that does not bode well for the Heat. So that's why I think if the Heat lose, the three-point game is going to come into play big time. Let's talk about why the Heat are going to win, though. I think it comes down to, well, they have home court advantage, right? So that's obviously an advantage. I think that the Heat's roster is playoff better than Charlotte's roster. Experience, guys that have done it before, that comes into play. So you come between the experience and the home court advantage. That's a major edge that serves the Heat well, and it's ultimately, I think, why they're favored. But I did want to talk about this another thing. The modern NBA is all about the 3-point shot and how you can beat teams, and it's the great equalizer, blah, 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 blah. Miami gets to the rim really, really well. I mean, between Goran Dragic and Dwayne Wade and Hassan Whiteside, you have three of some of the best finishers in the NBA. And if you're a Hornets fan, you have to worry about who is it you have protecting the rim. Zeller is fine, but he's not great. Al Jefferson is bad at protecting the rim. Kaminsky's a rookie and he's not good on defense, and he wasn't supposed to be. Marvin Williams does an okay job on help defense, but he's not going to be the linchpin to your rim protection strategy. So if you're the Hornets, you've got to really hope that you can kind of get in these guys' grill when they're along the perimeter, make sure that they can't get the running starts, try to defend those screens well and get bodies on them. And you mentioned foul trouble. That can lead to a lot of foul trouble for the Hornets. Miami could be getting to the line a lot in this series.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think it's a lot of contrasting styles. You've got a perimeter-based team in Charlotte. You've got one that's more about effectively. We saw that in the first half against Boston, and it was a completely different team in the third quarter when they were just jacking up shots from the perimeter, even from long range, not exactly three-point range. They were just a very ineffective team. They were able to dominate the first half because of their ability to get to the paint and then kick it out to their shooters who were knocking them down in the first half. That wasn't the case there. So you need to get open looks. You need to attack the paint. And I think that's a really good point about how they lack some, you know, they lack rim protection. They're not very good at protecting the rim. So if you're able to get to the rim effectively, you'll be able to create some more offense that way. Or if not, just find the open perimeter shooter, guys like Deng, who have been really good at knocking those down from the corners. Certainly Josh Richardson. And I think, you know, that's going to be an effective part of what Miami can do moving forward. So I think that's a really good point.
So let's talk about this coaching edge a little bit then. Eric Spoelstra versus Steve Clifford. We've hinted at it this entire podcast. How much is this going to come into play in this series?
I think for all the criticism that Spoelstra gets, you know, this is his element. He's been into the finals. He's been to the playoffs 6 out of his 7 seasons. This will be the 7th of his 8th season. So I think we know that Spoelstra is capable. Maybe, a lot of his critics might point to the fact that he had an uber-talented team during the Big 3 era, but he made in-game adjustments. I think he knows how to respond well. He knows how to keep the team focused, never let him get too high or too low. I think that's going to be a big part. I think Clifford has that ability. I think, you know, you look at overall what he's able to do over the course of the season and change the dynamic of the team, make them a more perimeter-based team, you know, keep them well-coached. You look at a guy like Jeremy Lamb, for example. You know, he started off the season so hot, but then he kind of reverted back to the player he was in Oklahoma City. Now he's on the end of the bench. He doesn't get any playing time at all. Clifford runs a tight ship, and you kind of need that very tight, you know, structure in place for the playoffs. But you also need to be a little bit more flexible, and I don't think Clifford has that flexibility at this point just because he lacks the experience of being in these kinds of situations and more intense ones that Spoelstra has the experience with. You know, he's seen it all at this point. He knows how to make those adjustments. I think he's going to be a significantly better coach during the series than Clifford is. So, but we saw, I think, Carlisle, we saw Vogel, we've seen others out-coach Spoelstra in previous playoff matchups. So that's going to be an interesting one, but I think Spoelstra gets the edge here.
I have to agree with you. I mean, Clifford is one of the guys that has been mentioned a lot in the Coach of the Year discussion, top 5, top 4 sometimes. And he's done a tremendous job. I don't want to take that away from him, but managing and coaching in the playoffs is different. And Clifford doesn't have that much experience doing it. The Hornets have been in the playoffs with him, but he doesn't have that much experience, especially not compared to Spoelstra. And you mentioned those in-game adjustments, those between-games adjustments. That is so much a part of the playoffs, where the regular season, coaching matters, sure. Clifford has proven that coaching matters in the regular season. Putting a system in place that helps your team matters, but teams don't practice a lot during the regular season. A lot of the coaching is in-game stuff, film room stuff, managing your assistants, making sure that you're getting appropriate breakdowns of your opponents game to game, managing minutes, managing health, doing all that stuff. The playoffs is really where coaches get paid, right? That's where it matters. And not that Clifford can't, but we just haven't seen it. So I give the edge to Spoelstra because he's been there, he's done it. He doesn't have to prove to himself that he has to do it, much less prove to anybody that he can do it. And I do give him that edge, especially because we know that if a player goes down, if Dwayne Wade gets hurt, if Dragic gets hurt, if Hassan Whiteside gets hurt, you know, he's shown an ability to adapt, and not just adapt with lineups, but adapt with entire rotation sets, entire systems, instill things on the fly, new practices with his team. He's shown that. Like So in the end, I give him the edge just because I trust him more in this situation.
Secondary coaching matchup: David Fizdale versus Pat Ewing. Who do you have?
In an intellectual battle, I have Fizdale. If it comes to fisticuffs, Ewing all the way. Break those glasses right in half. Ewing's good, though. Ewing's been a good coach. He's what, last year, couple years, he's been in interviews now for head coaching positions. He might not be there yet, but he's definitely one of those assistants on the rise, right?
Yeah, I think so.
But if you want to talk about just down the bench and organizationally, you know, this playoff culture, I think, is a real thing, right? Like, do you buy into the playoff culture?
I think so. I think, you know, I don't think it fit into the line of questioning you had for UD, but I mean, when I talked to him about it, he certainly pointed it out. And I know, you know, it becomes a little cliched and a little too oft repeated, but it's there for a reason. The players actually buy into it. Staff buys into it. We saw it evidence in the way they comport themselves in the locker room. So I think it's just something that you've seen. And I think that moving forward, they know that there's a bigger prize to go after. So it's not that they're going to overlook this first round opponent, but I think they're going to be able to prepare for them and adjust. And I like their chances in the series. Should we go so far as to make predictions?
I was going to ask you, I'm nervous though. I'm nervous about predictions. If you want to make one, go for it. If you make one, I'll make one, but I'm not going to make one before you do.
Nah, I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't feel comfortable. So
I just don't want to jinx it, man.
I've been really bad about them all season long. So
let's just end predictions. We're not going to be a prediction podcast. You want predictions? Go watch ESPN. But
there you go.
This is not what the Heat Check Pod is about. No more predictions at all, ever again. We'll probably do them eventually.
Do you have the full schedule in front of you? I know they're playing on Sunday at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time.
Yes, on TNT.
And then again
on
Tuesday.
And then we got screwed with the NBA TV game.
That's okay. That's okay.
Let's check it out right now. I got it up in front of me. It's just loading. So we got Sunday, 5:30 on TNT. And then a lot of days off. Sunday to Wednesday on NBA TV.
Oh, right? I assumed it was Tuesday. That's crazy.
April 20th, right? Did I do my math wrong?
No, you're right. Friday's the 22nd, so I that's amazing. That's
And then let's see, Saturday, April 23rd is game three
in Charlotte. And
that's the first game in Charlotte on TNT, and then game four doesn't have a TV national listing yet, but of course it'll be on Fox Sports Sun, as all these games are, and those times are TBD. So yeah, those first three games are set. I'm excited. Hey, you want to hear some really interesting news?
Absolutely.
The NBA playoffs start on my birthday this year. How about that?
That's amazing.
April 16th, this Saturday.
Well, wow. Congrats, man. Happy birthday.
Thanks, David. Yeah. I couldn't ask for anything better. They said, what do you want to do on your birthday? And I said, nothing. Go away. I'm watching basketball.
There you go. I think that's a good way of bringing family and friends together on a special occasion.
Exactly. And we'll get back together next week to do a podcast again. We'll probably talk about a few of these games. Hopefully, I don't know, Sunday, Wednesday, we'll try to maybe get two games out of the way before we talk about it. Maybe heading into Charlotte.
That's possible. I think Thursday's a good chance.
Yeah, Thursday's a good chance. Until then, thanks for listening. Thanks for joining me, David. And you can find the Heat Check podcast on the Hardwood Peroxisome Basketball Network, which is on Blog Talk Radio. You can find this podcast. Plenty of other really great podcasts over there. And David and I's writing over at hardwoodparoxysm.com. We'll be participating over there during the playoffs and doing a lot more pods coming up. So thanks for listening.
Happy birthday, Wes.
I woke up this morning, didn't recognize the man in the mirror. Then I laughed and I said, oh, silly me. That's just me. Then I proceeded to brush some stranger's teeth, but they were my teeth, and I was weightless, just quivering like some...
If I had to describe NCS with one word, the word I choose is phenomenal.
The best thing about NCS is that you're getting to meet loads of new people, and you're doing things that you'd never get to do if you didn't try it.
NCS has given me so many skills, not just like independent, teamwork, friendship. It's given me lots of experience that I can adapt to pretty much every situation in life.
I thought it was just something that would look good on my CV, but it's changed me as a person.
This summer, don't miss out on an experience to change your life. Search NCS for more info. With the holidays around the corner, now's your chance to save time and money at Safeway's Stock Up Sale. Plus, earn 4 times gas reward points on participating items. Look for tags on items like Honey Nut Cheerios. Select varieties are 4 for $8 with your club card. And select varieties of Betty Crocker Cake Mix, Brownie Mix, or Frosting are 10 for $10 with your club card. Maximum gas reward at participating Sunoco stations is 20 cents per gallon and $1 per gallon at Safeway stations in a single fill-up up to 25 gallons. Other restrictions, limitations, and exclusions apply. For complete details, go to Safeway.com.